Welcome to Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders. You've done it all. You've walked the tightrope of success and accomplished so much in your career. Now what? How do you keep redefining your success and expanding your emotional well-being? Join us to hear talk on mindset, motivation, and your growth in handling the challenges you've experienced both in circumstances and with yourself as a leader. Welcome to Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders with your host, Tracy Crossley.
Everybody, welcome back to another episode of Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Leaders, or I should say female leaders. And today I have with me another accomplished female leader. Today I have with me Lisa Peterson. Hey, Lisa.
Hello, Tracy and Tracy's community. I'm so happy to be here.
I am happy to have you because I know we are going to have an exciting talk today. So before we get started, you guys, let me inform you of what Lisa's background is. So Lisa is the Mindful Millionaire Maker. Yes, she is. She's a coach, author, business growth strategist, and founder of the Wealth Clinic. Lisa helps entrepreneurs and investors stop trading time for money. I love that. And she has a very long history in a financial background, right? Because you were, I forgot which bank you were with, but you were in banking for several years, right?
Yeah, almost two decades.
Right. How fun. Yes. It's never been my forte. So, you know, I'm like, okay, you must have enjoyed it for 20 years.
I learned a lot. I made a lot of money. That's enough.
Okay. So I like to start off this podcast with the question of when you were a little girl, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Great question. I did actually want to be the president of the United States. I will admit, I wanted to be the president. And then, kind of funny story, the whole thing happened with Clinton and whether he inhaled or not, and this will age me. And I was like, okay, everyone knows that I inhaled because I was a child of, you know, the 80s, and I can't be president. I literally thought, I'm a woman. I smoked pot when I was in high school, and I can now not become the president, is what I decided. So I tried other things.
That you tried other drugs or you tried other occupations?
I think that it was occupation. Yes, definitely occupation. But it's funny that back then, even then, I had an idea that a guy could maybe get away with this, but a girl couldn't. Mm-hmm.
Mm-mm. Yeah. So where did you get those kind of ideas from, Lisa? Where did that stem from?
Oh, that would be the culture that I grew up in. Yeah. Very sexist culture. And I think I can say that too, because I didn't work for a nonprofit. I didn't work in places where women were treated a certain way. And I worked in a very patriarchal, you know, industry, career. I was always there. I was always trying to fit in, you know, a gal trying to fit into a man's world. I chose that and I did very well with it, but it also took a toll on me big time.
So what made you choose it in the first place? Was it your interest in finance? What was the main driver?
You know, I write about this in my book, but I wanted to be rich. And I thought, well, where is the money? Oh, the money is with the banks. The money, I look around and every person that I know who works for banks is rich, not at the local level, right? I wasn't thinking I'm going to work in a bank branch. I knew that executives at banks made a lot of money and I wanted to make a lot of money. And that got me into banking. I got an MBA in finance before I went into that career. So along the ways, I'm like, maybe I could do this. And a little history about me, my parents barely finished high school. My mom supported the family cutting hair. My dad dealt drugs and was a truck dispatcher. And I came from the other side of the tracks. Like I grew up in a lower middle class, always struggling with money. you know, just a whole lifestyle of struggle. And so the idea that I could get an MBA in finance when my parents had barely finished high school was like, holy cow, anything is possible for me. I wanted to break the stereotype of coming from lower middle class in America. I wanted to go to the other side, and money and having money meant that I could break free of what I felt like was a lot of struggle, a lot of difficulty. I didn't want that for myself, and I didn't want that for my children if I ever had kids.
So did that break you free from having struggle?
It broke me free from having financial struggle, but I was still, without knowing, right, and unconsciously, I was still living in scarcity, even though I was making a lot of money and I had a lot of success in my career. And I knew that I could get a job and I could be paid well and I could get promotions and I could work with people who had come from that other side of the world. But I was different. It was like one of these things doesn't go with the other. I was that. And I gave myself a lot of suffering because I brought the mindset, I brought the poverty and scarcity mindset with me to this whole other world. And it would take me years to figure out that that didn't work and that I was just as unhappy, even though I was having success and I had money, I was still suffering inside.
Yeah, it's interesting how we can go for things. I think for a lot of us who have been, let's say, externally motivated, because as a kid, you look at your situation, right? And I think most of us as kids, we want to improve upon whatever our circumstances are, whatever they happen to be. And I think that we look at it on the outside, right? Because we can't see, let's say, how our parents feel. We can't actually see our relationship to what we think is bad or wrong or, you know, not great in our environment. And therefore, we don't see the internal, we just see the external. And I think a lot of us get driven by these external goals. And there's nothing wrong with having goals, but we get driven by them and we don't do anything about the inside because we don't even know we need to do something about the inside. Wouldn't you say that's the key?
100%. I did not know that there was this thing that I could do that would make me feel better about myself and about the life that I was creating. Like, I didn't know that that even existed because my parents, I mean, there's a difference between reading a motivational book. I did have those. I did read all of those books, you know, like whatever I could get my hands on as soon as I realized that that was something that could help me. But that's very different than breaking programming, like that you could actually not be haunted by these horrible negative voices inside, you know, your head all the time and all this stuff that I brought with me that my parents had, and they kind of gave it to me. I thought, this is how you go. You doubt yourself, you feel bad, you feel like you've made mistakes, all these things that haunted me. I didn't know I could change that. And so I just kept thinking, I got to make more money. I've got to get another promotion. If I'm successful in my career, then I will be happy with myself and other people will be happy with me too. So externally motivated. And yeah, it just ruptured. Thankfully, it just totally ruptured at some point.
So where did you get to, like, in your career before, you know, it ruptured and you realized, oh God, I can't keep doing this?
Yeah. I had a very, very big job at one of the major banks in the United States. I was running business development and co-branded partnerships. I would approach big companies like Ford and General Motors and Pitney Bowes and Dell Computer, Federal Express, and I would negotiate deals. Like, I'd be the starting point, the negotiator, and the finishing person who would like run those partnerships between these companies. And I had a lot of responsibility. I was running teams of, you know, up to 60, 70 people on projects and, you know, many millions of dollars in my budget. And I was on the track, the fast track to huge success. Had I stayed on that pathway, I could have done anything. But I want to note that because of these things that we're talking about, that self-doubt and other struggles, because of, I think, where I'd come from and the trauma in my background, I think that I could see the writing on the wall, that I wasn't made of the same stuff as other people who hadn't struggled like I had to get where I was. And so even though I had had a rapid rise to success, I think I knew that it was either going to cap out or I would self-sabotage. Like, I could just see that there were problems with it that weren't sustainable. And I got off the train, as they say, and I took a different kind of job inside the bank that made me the king of or queen of my own domain, which is I went into sales, first in mortgage banking and eventually as a financial advisor, because I realized that the corporate politics was not something that I was really good at when I wasn't healed, especially. Like, I would just get into the fray and I didn't know how to get out of it. And so I went into sales. Well, I started having huge success in that area for different reasons. And eventually even that wasn't enough. Like, it did, I got to the point where, you know, no matter how much success I have, this isn't going to work. I need to actually, you know, walk away and start my own business.
So here's the question, because, you know, I've had many conversations over the years with clients and with people I've interviewed and so on and so forth. And, you know, one of the things that became clear to me and in my own life too, was because I was super driven for many years, and it was climbing the mountain, right? And you're always climbing the mountain because you think at the top, you're going to feel different when you get there. You think you're going to actually, you know, either be a changed person, right? Or something is going to happen that is going to let you know, okay, you finally arrived. And in work, like as I'm working with people, myself, you never arrive. You just keep climbing mountains. It's like, okay, maybe this will take me there. Okay, maybe that will take me there. Maybe this will have a payoff. And it has nothing to do with all of the accoutrements you get. It has to do with how you feel inside. Like, you don't feel like the winner that you look like. You don't feel like that person, and, you know, call it imposter syndrome or whatever, but I don't think we're taught that. You know, we're just taught, no, you have to go out there and succeed and blah, blah, blah. And then as a woman, you have like extra special obstacles in your way. But what would you say to what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. What's coming up for me is that, you know, first of all, back in 1999, I had a family tragedy. My dad was brutally murdered by his ex-girlfriend and her boyfriend. And when that happened, I was in this really big job in the bank, and those worlds kind of collided for a bit of time. But what I did was I stayed in my career path, but I also began this inner journey. So this is like 24 years now ago, I began parallel paths. And if I hadn't done that, Tracy, I am not kidding you, I hate to say this, but I'm not sure that I would still be here. Like, if my dad's death hadn't happened, I was so unhappy and I couldn't help myself, and I'm not sure I'd still be here. But because I went down that path and I started getting, you know, healing myself through spiritual practices and becoming mindful of who I was and who I wanted to be, it changed everything. So along the way, I started noticing that I had been so externally focused, and that I had drunk the Kool-Aid, as they say, and that wasn't healthy for me, and I needed to make a change. But even as a business owner now, 9 years in, I've had some really big epiphanies where I'm like, there is, like, my ideas of what might be possible or what I want to achieve externally and what's actually happened in my business, there's a disconnect if I'm not careful. And I can see myself being constantly disappointed. One part of me could be disappointed that no matter how many books I write, no matter how much money I have, no matter how much success and how many people, you know, reference my work, I'm still not arriving. And that is a very, very dangerous place. And because of my time spent in inner work, I look at that and I see it and I'm like, no, like, I cannot dictate my life based on always being disappointed in, like, not having these things that actually aren't really important to me. I don't need more money. I don't need more success. I have the greatest, most beautiful community of friends and family. I have everything I ever wanted. And like that, having that realization is the greatest gift I could ever give myself, because I saw that that other path was never going to get me the kind of happiness I was seeking. I had to like slow down and take stock and be like, dang, I'm grateful and I'm fortunate and this is actually enough. But I had to make that decision. Nobody was going to give me permission to do that.
I love that. And then, you know, looking at the past and then moving forward. So it sounds like you've always taken a leadership position, even though you may not have felt like a leader at times, you know, because of how, you know, we're raised and again, how we see ourselves. So, you know, what made you want to lead?
You know, early on, I think that it was very externally motivated, that if I could lead people, that would mean that I was a capable human being who actually could earn the respect of others. And that's like sad. Like, I'm just being so honest about those inner thoughts. Like, I thought that that would validate me. But over time, that has changed. And I think I've had to revisit it many times, because again, there was just this part of me that was like, I'm going to prove that I'm a good person, that I can be helpful to others, and that I can make an impact in people's lives. And in the past few years, particularly, I'm 56. And so this in the 50s, like so many things happening, you know, my children are getting older. My body's changing, my thoughts, I mean, how much energy I have, all of those things changing and slowing me down has given me time to be like, okay, what is important to you? And I think when I look back at my path, what really matters to me and why I think I've been a leader all these years is because I care about other human beings so much, oftentimes like more than I even care about myself, for better or for worse. But I love people. Some people love dogs. I love people. Like, I love people. I love being with them. I love watching them have their breakthroughs. I love people being excited about life. And if there was something in my story that could be shared with someone else that causes them to love their life and feel more joy in their life, I'm totally complete. And I think that this is all that I've ever cared about, truly. I just didn't understand it for many years. That's all I was wanting to do. Just be here in loving presence, seeing if any small part of my story or my life or my experiences could be of benefit to other people. That's why I think I was like acting like a leader all these years.
I like that. And I think that as a leader, you have to care about other people to some degree, because if you don't, then you're really not a leader. You're a lone wolf, basically. So tell me about some of the challenges you've encountered being a female leader. Like, what are some things that, you know, you've either found challenging at times, or, you know, are just obstacles, whether it's because you're a female or you're a leader or both?
Well, I'll give you a couple stories. One goes way back, and I love telling this story to women leaders because, again, I had this opportunity almost 20 years ago to have this huge job with lots of responsibility. And some of your listeners probably work for others. And so I just want to tell this quick story, which is my boss at the bank, who was, I mean, we were like 2 to 3 levels from the CEO of the whole entire bank. And this is one of the biggest banks in the world. So I had a big job, but she had an even bigger job. She was on maternity leave and she had an assistant helping out. And that assistant happened to print out the salaries of everyone on the team, but she forgot about it or something. And I, that same day, was printing hundreds of pages out for a project I was working on the shared printer. I took that and got onto BART at the end of the day home with me. And halfway through the ride home, I come across all the salaries of everyone on at this team. Long story short, turns out even working for a woman, the men were all paid at least 20 to 25% higher than all the women on the team. This was way before it was all being shared or starting to share or what have you. And I was like, you've got to be kidding. And I couldn't do anything. I knew this woman would get in so much trouble. I didn't tell anyone. I just kept it mum. But within a few months, I decided to renegotiate with a different boss. And I knew this information. And so I was like, I have the keys to the kingdom, basically. And I negotiated a 30, maybe 40% raise. Not because I told him what I knew, but because once I knew that, I was like, I will never be undervalued again. And I acted that way. Like, this is what you're going to pay me. I know you can. And I just think that so often we women settle for far less than they don't ask for the raises. They don't negotiate their raises. Like, this is proven over and over again. And that experience directly changed my attitude, especially within the corporate world, that I don't care what it takes, but do a ton of research on how much can be paid in a role, what the threshold is, and push it so much further than you think that it's probably even possible. And you might be shocked at what can actually happen. So that was one experience where I was like, oh gosh. And yes, this was a long time ago, but I still think it's happening, sadly.
Oh yeah.
The data says it, right? That women are paid less. The other thing that I will say that happened more recently is I got to be on Gaia TV. And I was so excited. I've written this book. I'm invited to come and be interviewed for this interview on this streaming service. And they fly me in and put me up at this beautiful hotel, and I have a chauffeur. And I mean, you're just like, okay, I've made it. I get into the studio, everything's awesome. We've got four segments that I've rehearsed, and I know what we're going to cover, and I'm going to teach, and this interview is going to go a certain way. And I'm being interviewed by a man who's in his probably mid to late 60s, and so kind of old school. And right before we go live, we're getting our mics put on us, and he's getting his mic on, and he looks at me, and I'm getting my mic on. And then we sat down, and they're like, okay, cameras are running. He said, looks at me, and he says, she's so attractive. I don't know if I'm going to be able to focus.
Wow.
I was like, and I'm just going to share, I'm sharing this because here's the deal. I did not perform very well after that happened. I was like a deer in headlights because I'm thinking, I felt so demeaned that I had written a book. I've been invited to the studio, and here this whole conversation is being set up as all about my looks. I felt objectified. I was pissed off, and I had to save face because a camera's on me, and I am so excited about this opportunity. And sadly, I did not do very well on that interview. It breaks my heart to this day because it was still there. I couldn't stop that objectification of like us being judged by what we look like and not by our merits, and that it was still happening here, you know, last couple of years. And it breaks my heart, and it probably makes me even more passionate when especially men don't understand that you can't treat us that way anymore, because it matters. Like, it's like trauma that we don't even know that we're carrying in our bodies and in our minds and in our psyches that gets activated when people behave that way. But it happens all the time. Still to this day, I was in a networking group and someone said, my marketing is like a lap dance for your, and I was like, I couldn't even hear what he said after that. But I'm like, what the hell? This stuff still happens. Just today that happened. This was a young person talking about his little elevator pitch about marketing and comparing his marketing to a lap dance. I did not stop it because I am not that person, but man, I was like, you just lost all respect. I don't care if you don't know, but like, you can't do that. So there's my little rant, because I feel like we need to say these things. Like, this stuff still happens and people don't realize how demeaning it is. But I will say too, if it does happen to you, please, please know that I messed up and maybe you don't have to, because I couldn't recover fast enough. But I won't let that happen to me again. I will be prepared to be like, don't let that stuff stop you from being in your power. It did in that moment for me.
Yeah, because what men do when they do that, you know, they're so used to doing it, they probably don't realize it. They're probably unconsciously doing it. You know, a lot of times we want to go, no, they're consciously, but if they've been doing it their whole lives, they probably have no idea that they're being offensive or demeaning 100%. Or anything else. And that is where change needs to happen, is in the education of human beings, female and male. Because here's the problem, and I talk about this a lot. I talk about prescriptive and descriptive bias. Descriptive bias says you're a woman. Prescriptive bias says, here are all the behaviors I expect from a woman. And what happens is, okay, society's hearing that, but guess what? It gets in your head and you judge yourself. You judge how you come across. Uh-oh, I'm not female enough. And, oh, I'm too female. Oh, you're constantly playing bingo in your brain because you're trying to figure out, well, who's going to accept me? But the bottom line is you have to accept yourself. And I think that's the hardest thing, because we're not taught this as children. We're not taught this unless we go seek it out. You know, how do I accept myself? How do I love myself? How do I do these things that are talked about? You know, and it's really sad, because until women get this shit out of their head, it doesn't matter. Because we can't rely on circumstances outside of us. We can't rely on men or other women to act in appropriate manners, because they're not going to until they decide for themselves, oh, hey, maybe I need to change how I come across, you know. And that's why I'm always like, it always comes back to the self, always comes back to the self.
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful. I have a son who's 18, and I mean, he is so cognizant of what's appropriate and what isn't. And I am so proud of him, because I don't know that I had, you know, any one thing that I did, but I watch him and I listen to him, whether it be around race or sex or any ism, you know, like, he is very cognizant. And I'm like, thank God. My daughter is too, but I think I probably, because of my own experiences, I get a little concerned, maybe more concerned about my son. And thank goodness my husband isn't, he's so sensitive about these things. And so I think that I, in my cocoon, think it's one way. And then I go out into the world and I see these things and I'm like, wow, there's still a lot of learning that needs to happen. And I don't know the perfect answer to it, but I do hope that each and every day I become better at, like, how do you handle those situations? Like, how can we be better when the situation happens? What do we say? Do we speak up? Do we send a note on the side? You know, like, how do we make a difference with our leadership, right? The whole point of what you're doing, because being quiet doesn't work.
No, it does not work. You know, I always bring this other little stat up in each of these interviews, and it goes along with this. Only 21% of CEOs in the United States of America are female. What the hell, right? And some women will say, oh my God, that's more than I thought. Or, oh my God, yeah, that sounds about right. And especially women that have gotten to the C level, you know, maybe they're not the CEO, but they're at the C level. And they're like, yeah, there's far less women at my level, or I'm the only woman at this level, you know? And it's because of so many, you know, some of the things you're talking about, you know, whether it's the equality, right, in the workplace, of title, of money, of, you know, having the position. It's also, well, you know, she's going to go get pregnant and, you know, we can't trust that, you know, she's going to be on that career track, whatever bullshit they're playing, right? And, you know, so, and women, I think also, you know, there's been this great exodus of female leaders from the workforce, right? A lot of them going and starting their own businesses. Yahoo for you, by the way. Congratulations. But what would you say to that? What are your observations on this?
Well, I know that there are, that it is hard for organizations to hold on to women who have self-actualized. Let's just say that, because there comes a time and place where you're like, I am speaking, I am working hard to make a difference, and it's not going anywhere. That, like, the law of diminishing returns, where you're still working just as hard, but you're not noticing the impact of what your leadership is all about. I've had so many colleagues, so many friends, women executives get to the top of huge companies in the United States, and just at the time when you would think that they were thriving, they would be like calling the shots. They're being like let go or merged out, or a leadership change happens, and all of a sudden it's like they can't even stand, you know, the new person that's been put in charge of their role, and they leave. It happens so much. And so I think that this is probably more unconscious than conscious. Just like you said before, it's not like people know that this is happening, but there is a lot of unconscious bias that occurs at the upper levels of the organizations that make it very difficult for women to continue thriving or to even reach those top, you know, the CEO position, for example. I am fascinated by those who get through the cracks, but I do feel like they're cracks, not wide open gates for them to do, you know, what you would think based on their past experience.
Right. I totally get that. So do you have any suggestions? You know, like, anybody listening, here's some suggestions. I have my own, but I'm curious if you have some.
You know, I don't, because I decided to leave. And so I don't know that I can say, here's what you should do, when I haven't actually done it myself. However, this is when I'd like to bring in money for a moment, because mm-hmm. I am a money expert, and I have done one thing very, very well throughout my career, which is spend a lot less money than I make. And I have done that from the beginning, which has allowed me, you know, in my mid 30s to potentially even retire at that time. But I'll tell you, okay, you said I could swear. Fuck you, yep. Money is very yep. important. And fuck you money says basically no one owns me. I can do whatever I want because I'm taken care of financially now mm-hmm. and in the future. And so one thing that I have found in my own career is that when I have omnipotent power to say, I'm going to stay or I'm going to go because I don't need your money, I become a much more powerful person in the room and people can feel it. So being really good at your job, which I think women are continuously doing that. That's why I'm mm-hmm. not going to tell you just be better at your job, because you're already probably mm-hmm. amazing. But add in, be awesome with money, figure out your money house, spend less money than you earn, save it, invest it, take care of your future, so that at any point in time, you're like, I don't need this. I don't need the money. Now you're going to convince me why I should stay, because while you're going to pay me plenty of money, that's not why I'm staying. I'm staying because of the responsibility you're going to give me. I'm staying because of the impact that I'm going to make in this organization. And that comes off different when you don't need the money.
I love that. And I think that's so true. You know, I look at it too from the perspective of women have to get out of their own way. And until you decide to get out of your own way, you're going to be affected by the circumstances in a much deeper manner. Because you're going to personalize it. You're going to think it's about you. When it's not about you, it's about the environment you're in. and its own toxicity or whatever happens to be going on. And for you, it's to come to, I want to be confident because I breathe, not based on what I can do or can't do, or, you know, how I look or anything like that. Because when you're actually truly confident, your confidence isn't shaken. Your confidence isn't taken away by somebody else. It's something that you get to have, but you often have to work through your own bias, your own obstacles, your insecurities, all of those things. I believe then make women do the thing that we really need to do. And I'm going to bring this one up too, which is we need to stop competing with other women. We need to stop comparing ourselves to other women, and we need to stop judging other women. What would you say to that, Lisa?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I've been guilty of it and I don't want it anymore. So I'm here in the crowd, the cheer crowd. Something I said yesterday, I was with a group of beautiful, incredible women here in Sedona. We just met and had this beautiful Valentine's Day inspiring conversation about spirituality. It was so much fun. And when I was doing my little, like, what are you excited about? I was talking about grandmother energy. And it was really interesting because I've never thought of this before. But like, You know how, so we both have daughters. So there can be this thing that happens with daughters and mothers where you can, I don't feel this so much, but my mom and I definitely had it, where there's jealousy and kind of this thing that goes back and forth of like, I don't know. It was weird with my mom. Thankfully, not so much with my daughter. But with grandmother energy, you're like, it doesn't matter about the grandkid. Like, you just want them to be happy and have fun, and you want to help them and you want to support them in any way, including rolling around on the floor, playing with them. Like, there's just no charades. There's no, like, I've got to show you how to do this right. It's more of just grandmotherly love. So I'm super excited. Like, my daughter isn't listening to this, and she is not ready to be a mom. So just saying, but I want to live the rest of my life like a grandmother who just is like, there is no competition. I just want to be in service. I want to be in love. I want to help. I want to see what I can do to support, lift up, not just inspire, but like reflect back, you know, how beautiful women are in the world, how hard they have worked to get where they are, and how can I be of service to that in whatever way that speaks to them and to me. And so, does that make any sense? I'm hoping it does.
Yeah, it does. Because it's, you know, we go back generations, okay? Like, you know, hundreds of years of generations, all right? Here's the deal. Who had self-awareness back then? Nobody. Nobody had 500 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago. So we unknowingly pass so much shit down to the next descendant without having any awareness we're doing it, right? So back in the old days when we were property, or, you know, women didn't really have any rights, it's like we still pass down some of the shame and the guilt and the other crap without having any conscious awareness for doing it, right? Like, I'm not aware because I'm just doing what my mom did, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's not a blame thing. It's a, when your culture, when your society continues to play the same record over and over, you know, as a human, as a young kid, you pick it up and you go with it because you don't know any better. But women had to compete back in those days. Women had to, you know, worry somebody else was going to come and take their place and they'd be homeless. You know, there were all sorts of things that women had to worry about when it came to not really having any rights or, you know, a way to make a living or what have you. And so I look at that and I think, well, that's where a lot of the competition comes from, right? Somebody younger, somebody prettier, somebody smarter, somebody, you know, and we're comparing. What is she doing that I'm not doing? How come I'm not, you know, there? And we don't really do this with men. We do it differently with men, but we do it with women. And it's really about, to me, it's getting out of that, like getting yourself out of that space and building your self-worth and building your confidence. But again, not based on what your abilities are based on the fact that you're alive and you breathe, which I think is grandmother energy. Because when you are set free of all these like obstacles in your way, you can do these things, no problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the competition thing. Well, women have just had different standards applied to them that are more like nebulous. Like one person is attractive to one person, but maybe not to another. But then women are supposed to look attractive to everyone. And so now you get, you know, like all the plastic surgery and like the way you look and your style, and like there's just so much pressure again and again on the external achievements. I think that's what the theme of this conversation is it's like what you look like, how much money you make, how what you're dressed like, all of those things are actually more conducive to competition than when you feel good about yourself, like you said, when you feel really good about who you are, just because of you being you, there is no competition for that. There's nothing to compare. You're like, I feel good and I want everyone else to feel good. But there's something in there that causes us to feel like we should be externally focused. Women are encouraged to be externally focused, but that you'll never win that way. So when we're internally focused and we're focused on, am I happy? Am I doing something that provides rewards that I appreciate and enjoy? Am I feeling content and satisfied with the life that I'm living right now? Those are not comparable things. It doesn't even matter. You're not like, oh, am I happy? And how does my happiness compare to that person's happiness? Not saying that you couldn't do it, but it'd be work. Right. Like you're not going to know. There's no scale. There's no barometer to compete.
Right. Right. There isn't. There isn't any. I love that.
So we need to like realize that it has been the external focus that causes us to go into those competitional like frames of mind. But if we are focused on the inner development and what makes us happy and figuring those things out, we will be less likely to spend any time competing. And when we're not spending time competing, what are we doing with our time? We are looking at how can we uplift? How can we support? How can we be that one phone call away for the people who we could make an impact at the right time for? You know, like we become completely oriented to service over competition.
I love that. I do. I love the passion too. It's there. You know? I got it too. All right. So Lisa, I've loved this conversation and we could keep talking, I think, all day long because it's just so engaging and it's so important. So if anybody would like to find you, how can they find you? And also, what would you like to leave our audience with?
So going to wealthclinic.com/vision will get you the first chapter of my book and a meditation about chakras and money. And I think that the title of my book, Mindful Millionaire. Now, I say right away, it's not about how many zeros you have in your net worth, but it's about how do you feel about the life that you're living. Like we can all be millionaires immediately by truly trusting that we are living on purpose, that we are headed in the direction that we want to go in. And so I would just say empowerment with money, empowerment with your thoughts and your feelings and knowing the difference between emotions and, you know, like really owning your experiences is everything. Like feeling Like, you know the secrets to what brings you happiness. If you figure that out, you are going to be a leader of other people no matter what. And that's what's coming up.
I like that. Thank you for that. And so, again, Lisa has a great book, The Mindful Millionaire, which I think you can find at all booksellers worldwide, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And check out her work. And of course, check out the chapter of her book. And Lisa, again, I love this conversation. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tracy. You ask great questions. I love being with you.
Yeah, I love being with you too. By the way, she's part of my mastermind that I talk about. So yay, she's one of the women in there. So anyway, all right, you guys, take care and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining today. For more information on Tracy and her programs and to set up a discovery session, email business@tracycrossley.com. That's business@tracycrossley.com, and go to tracycrossley.com to get your free download entitled Stop Your Inner Dictator. Thank you for tuning in to Earned Wisdom for Accomplished Female Leaders.